Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Mann, the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. He has an article at the Scientific American, Earth Will Cross the Climate Danger Threshold by 2036. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Mann.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
And there's three things I wanted to talk about. Well, obviously your article. I also want to talk about the recent Senate all-nighter on climate change, the White House's new website on climate change, and Hillary Clinton's remarks to students at Arizona State University that she hopes there will be a mass movement that demands political change to address global warming. So why don't you just take them in whatever order you want?
The full plate. We could start out talking about this article in Scientific American, that it's now out on the website, and it's in the April print issue of Scientific American, so it should be at the newsstands shortly. It addresses an issue that has gotten a lot of attention over the past year or so. The issue of the so-called pause in global warming. In fact, I originally wanted to title the article Faux Pause, False Pause, because there really isn't a pause in global warming, despite what you might gather from reading certain news sites or from following discussions of the issue in the, you know, mainstream media, the public discourse. So it has to do with the fact that the globe has not warmed as much over the past 10 years or so as some models suggest that it should have. And it turns out that there are a number of reasons for that. We understand quite well that the most likely explanation of that is the fact that there has been some volcanic activity, which is a cooling factor that wasn't completely taken into account in the models, a small dip in the amount of energy coming in from the sun, and just sort of the vagaries of natural random climate variability. We've had a number of large La Nina events. La Nina is the flip side to the El Nino phenomenon. And during La Ninas, the globe is a little bit cooler than it otherwise would be. And so if you have a number of those events over a 2, 3, 4, 5 year period, it can actually lower the average temperature of that period, and it can dampen the warming. And the fundamental point here is that nothing that's happened in the past 10 years in any way changes the forecast for the future. And what I show in this article is that even if you are take into account all of the various factors that might lead the climate to be a little bit less sensitive to greenhouse gases than the IPCC's best estimate, even if you take into account the possibility that the climate is a little bit less sensitive to our pumping of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, you come up with the conclusion that we will commit to 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet, roughly 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the planet within a matter of 2 or at most 3 decades. And if the climate sensitivity, as the critics like to try to argue, was lower than what the IPCC says it's most likely to be by, say, 0.5 degree C, which would be sort of an extreme scenario, it would assume that the so-called pause, the faux pause, is somehow indicative of a climate that is less sensitive to greenhouse gases. Even if we take that into account, we're still a matter of 3 decades at most from crossing that 2 degrees Celsius, 3.5 degree Fahrenheit threshold. That is a threshold that most scientists studying the impacts of climate change have concluded is where we really start to commit ourselves to the most dangerous and potentially irreversible impacts on our climate. So the point of this piece, which ended up being called False Hope, is that the so-called pause, the speed bump in global warming of the past 10 years, is no cause for decreased concern about our ongoing warming of the planet. And in many respects, as we can see with the rapid melting of Arctic sea ice, We are actually proceeding ahead of schedule in terms of the impacts of climate change that we're seeing and the damage that's already having. So those were the points made by this piece, and I would encourage people to check it out. Again, it should be at the newsstands either now or shortly, the April issue of Scientific American.
Well, there's a tendency, though, surely, Michael Mann, after all, Al Gore called his film The Inconvenient Truth about climate change, and you have these active global warming deniers funded by billionaires like the Koch brothers and others who are actively trying to spread disinformation and slow down efforts to address this looming problem. And then I think there's a natural tendency in most people not to want to hear bad news and in many ways to blame the messenger.
That's right. And, you know, the real damage that this disinformation campaign does to our discourse is it sort of gives reasonable people an excuse for neglecting a problem that they really cannot afford to neglect. You know, we have so many problems, issues that we all have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, that if we're told that climate change is somehow a very far-off problem or less of a problem than we've been led to believe, it's quite understandable that reasonable people will sort of lower the climate change issue. They'll sort of push that down on their list of priorities, on the things that they're concerned about and the things that they demand action on. And so when, you know, we hear that climate change is an overblown problem, that it's not as bad as we thought, that message is not faithful to what the scientific evidence indicates. The evidence indicates that it's a real problem. If we don't do something about it soon, it will become a catastrophic problem. But there has been so much misinformation and disinformation that it's led to confusion. And that's what the critics, the professional climate change deniers, often, as you know, tied to fossil fuel interests or right-wing interests like the Koch brothers, that's what they're seeking to do. They're seeking to cloud the public discussion. They're seeking to confuse the public so that they just throw up their hands, so that we throw up our hands and say, well, you know, some scientists say it's a problem, others say it isn't. You know, I'm not going to worry about it. It's still, you know, there's no consensus about this problem. I'm going to focus on other things, bread and butter, you know, issues that that are influencing me on a daily basis. And that would be wrongheaded, because the fact is that climate change is what's called by some a threat multiplier. All of the problems that we deal with, whether it's food, human health, access to fresh water, national security, all of these things will be very negatively impacted by climate change if we don't do something about it and immediately.
Well, not to blame the Koch brothers for everything, I think you can also blame one of the greatest villains of all in climate change denial is Rupert Murdoch, whose News Corporation, the second biggest investor in the News Corporation, their family-owned business, a short of the Murdoch family, is the kingdom fund of the royal family of Saudi Arabia. And we know what interests they have in selling oil. So the whole thing is deeply cynical. What did you make then of Hillary Clinton's call to action with the students at Arizona State University that they should form a mass movement demanding political change?
Well, I thought that was great, actually. I think that one of the ways that change is most likely to come is through pressure, public pressure, especially, you know, exerted by those who are most passionate about this issue, who understand that this is really about their future. And one of the things that gives me great optimism when I travel around and I lecture about the climate change crisis is the fact that I meet so many younger folks, college students, people in their 20s or early 30s, who get it. They understand that this is a real problem, that it's not some distant, far-off issue, that it's something that's influencing them now and is going to become ever more problematic if we don't do something about it. And they realize it's about their future. They realize that it's about making the decisions now that we need to make so that we don't leave behind a fundamentally degraded planet for the next generation and the generation beyond that. So one of the ways that, you know, college students have historically influenced the public dialogue is by, you know, movements organized around college campuses. And right now, Bill McKibben of the organization 350.org is leading an effort to get universities, colleges and universities, to try to divest themselves of, you know, stocks in those companies who are actively financing a climate change disinformation effort. And I think that that is a critical way of exerting pressure on corporations and companies that, unfortunately, in some case, have not acted in the public interest and are instead acting in their own near-term self-interest.
Well, Michael Mann, I recently spoke with Senator Bernie Sanders on the eve of the Senate all-nighter that took place about a couple of weeks ago, and I haven't heard any follow-through on what happened as a result of the Senate staying up all night to discuss and debate climate change.
Well, you know, I think that it was an effort to draw some attention to, you know, an issue which doesn't often get as much attention as it really deserves, given, you know, the existential threat that it ultimately presents to us. And unfortunately, there was not as much media coverage of that event as one might have expected and hoped, and that is part of the problem. It's been difficult to get sort of mainstream media organizations to cover climate change with the prominence that it deserves. And part of that, I think, is the fact that it's, you know, unlike a lot of, you know, issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, it is a slow but steady mounting problem. It is a problem that emerges over years and decades at a time. And historically, we're not great at dealing with slowly mounting problems in the same way that, you know, the supposed frog who in the water that slowly, the temperature slowly heated up to the boiling point doesn't jump out because it's only sensitive to abrupt changes. We can't afford to wait for, you know, catastrophic events, you know, more Hurricane Sandys or more summers like those we've seen in recent years in the U.S., where we've had massive drought and unprecedented heat that's destroyed our crops, that has led to massive wildfires in the western U.S. We can't wait until climate change becomes a full-blown catastrophe to act on this problem, because if we do, we will have already ensured decades and centuries of even greater warming and climate change and sea level rise into the future. It's a very pernicious problem in that it has a procrastination penalty, unlike just about any other problem that we've dealt with, where the actions we take now with our energy choices, with our emission of carbon into the atmosphere, those actions have a legacy of decades and even centuries in terms of the climate change that we're putting into the pipeline.
So, Michael Mann, what do you make of the White House's new website on climate change?
Well, I think it's great that, you know, the White House, that the executive branch has taken a high-profile and a very sort of forceful approach to trying to confront the climate change crisis over the past year or two. The president, of course, is engaged in some executive actions like placing, you know, the EPA placing restrictions on the carbon emissions standards for coal-fired power plants, putting in incentives for clean, non-fossil fuel-based energy. The executive branch really has done, you know, just about all you could ask of it, given that we have this intransigence right now in our Congress. I mean, what we really need is a comprehensive climate bill, but we have a, you know, House of Representatives that's led by a group of Republicans that doesn't even accept that climate change exists. So there really aren't any short-term prospects for legislative action. And so that's forced the president to use what levers are available to him to do what he can. And I you know, applaud the president for having done that. Now, that having been said, as we all know, there's a very critical decision that is coming up. That is the decision over whether or not the administration will approve the Keystone XL pipeline. Many of us think that that would be a very bad idea. It would lock in additional carbon emissions, very dirty carbon tar sands oil, very inefficient, very expensive, and very dirty from a climate standpoint, heavy carbon footprint form of fossil fuel energy. If we are to, you know, if we build that pipeline, we're going to ensure the burning of many more gigatons, billions of tons of carbon, and the climate change that that will create. And the president in a State of the Union address earlier this year said that he doesn't want to look back and have to, you know, answer to his, you know, children and grandchildren why we had the power to act, to do something about the problem, and we failed to do so. He doesn't want to have to be in a position to look back and do that and say that. And if he means his word, then many of us feel that he cannot approve the Keystone XL pipeline. So that'll be a real critical test as to how serious the administration really is about the climate change problem.
Well, just in closing, Michael Mann, before we went on the air, I spoke with an expert on satellite oceanography. Obviously, I was trying to find out about these new satellite pictures from the Indian Ocean looking for the missing Malaysian airliner. He pointed out that the instrumentation that they have from satellites is extraordinarily accurate. And that the, one of the big issues, of course, is the water, the temperature of the ocean below 2,000 meters. How accurate these readings are that they can get from satellites. And it leads me to the conclusion that scientists are by nature very conservative. They don't jump out ahead of themselves. It's such an absurdity to suggest that somehow a bunch of scientists are making up stuff about climate change when, one, the instrumentation now is so accurate,
right,
and two, scientists by nature are conservative.
Well, it's a great point, and I think I can tie it all in together in a coherent way, because, in fact, one of the ways that we're able to measure sea level rise is through these extremely precise satellite measurements. We can actually measure very small changes in the height of the sea surface. We can measure changes in the amount of ice stored in the ice sheets. We can measure fairly subtle changes in how much ice is stored in the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet. And so it's these very precise satellite measurements that have actually led to the conclusion that the ice is melting. The major ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet and the Antarctic ice sheet, are losing mass ahead of schedule, earlier than we expected them to. They are contributing to sea level rise earlier than we expected them to. And so, indeed, this is an example of where, if you look at the projections that climate scientists had made, for example, in the previous IPCC reports, they were too conservative. The observations are telling us that the ice is melting faster than the scientists said it should just a decade ago, and that sea level is rising faster than we expected it to. So, indeed, we have very precise, increasingly precise measurements. There's a lot of really fascinating and rewarding science that's involved in the detective work of figuring out how we can take those measurements and turn them into estimates of sea level rise and estimates of how much ice is locked in the ice sheets. And that data that's coming in tells us that climate change, in many respects, is unfolding faster, that it's a bigger problem than we thought even a decade ago.
Well, Michael Mann, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Mann, who's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's the co-founder and contributor to the award-winning science website realclimate.org. And in 2007, he shared the Nobel Peace Prize with others on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His books include Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. He has an article at the New Scientific American, Earth will cross the climate danger threshold by 2036. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the scientist who predicted the recent Big Bang breakthrough in 1983.